KIOS-FM presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, May 22, 2003, for broadcast at this time. Today's topic will be Cuba, the Nebraska Connection. The members of the panel will be Kathy Huddle, Sunday editor of the Lincoln Journal-Star, Joe Dugan, a reporter and student at UNL, and Joe Starita, a UNL professor who leads the depth reporting class. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Bill Kelly, NETV Executive Producer.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Omaha Press Club Noon Forum. My name is Bill Kelly. I'm the moderator today and also Executive Producer for News at NETV. Thanks to all of you joining us here today and also on the radio on KIOS. When I first approached Gary Kerr, who coordinates these forums, with the idea of hosting a forum on Cuba and the reporting recently done there by Nebraska journalists, he was a little hesitant since it didn't seem like Cuba was a very hot topic back in January. But as often happens, the news caught up with us. Cuba is very much in the news lately. The Bush administration took a new hard line last fall and courting and encouraging dissidents on the island. Fidel Castro responded by throwing many of them in jail, and in a much publicized incident, executed three people attempting to escape the island. Efforts to end or at least curtail the trade embargo with Cuba from congressional leaders and the agribusiness community, many with Nebraska ties, go on, but now with new caution. And now the White House steps forward again with new restrictions on travel and a complete review of the United States policy towards Cuba. And I might add also, just as importantly, the cultural fascination that America is gaining with Cuba, with its music and its art and all the rest. Meanwhile, Fidel Castro goes on and on and on and on, much to everyone's amazement, I think. Joe Starita of the University of Nebraska College of Journalism deserves credit for being the most perceptive person in the room when it comes to Cuba. He decided this was a fascinating country that would be a great topic for his depth reporting class. He takes a select group of student journalists, immerses them in a topic for a year, and expects them to come up with world-class reporting in the form of a magazine and a documentary on the project. So in January, halfway through their project, it was off to Cuba with a stopover in Miami to also visit the epicenter of Cuban-American politics. Joe, in his own right, is an outstanding journalist with experience as an editor with the Lincoln Journal-Star and at the Miami Herald as well. Joe joins us today along with two reporters with the Lincoln Journal-Star who were on the trip both as students and as representatives of their paper. Kathy Huddle is the Sunday editor of the Journal-Star. Joe Dugan is the Greater Nebraska reporter for the paper. Their reporting is on Cuba is still available on the paper's website at journalstar.com. And also, if you have an opportunity after the forum, we've got a couple of reprints of their work up here, along with the really outstanding photography of their colleague Ken Blackbird. I was also privileged to be part of the trip as well. Our documentary on the subject, Nebraska Connects with Cuba, is part of a national PBS initiative called By the People. Our program concentrates on some of the surprising connections Nebraska has with the island and how foreign policy decisions can end up affecting average people in some unexpected ways. We're going to take your questions, but first we want to give each of our panelists an opportunity to talk a little bit about Cuba, potential for trade with the country and the like, and the reporting project as the whole. And first want to turn to Joe Starita of the University of Nebraska College of Journalism.
Thank you, Bill. I would just say in my opening remarks that one of the things that we try and do at the University of Nebraska College of Journalism is take some of our best and brightest students every year and get them out of the classroom. They have endured professor after professor and chapter after chapter and theory after theory, and at some point we want to wed that to as real life and as experience as we can provide. And I think the dozen students that we took to Miami and Cuba, we gave them an experience that will go a long way in shaping their journalistic lives. We were able to experience things see things and do things that you could never hope to replicate in a classroom. And these students, everybody in this room should be proud of these students. If you think that your tax dollars are being squandered, and maybe in some ways they are, this would not be Exhibit A to drive home that point. These students got to see things in Cuba that will just be a tremendous benefit for all of us. They interviewed 171 people in 11 days in Miami and Havana. They interviewed the publisher of the Miami Herald. They interviewed U.S. Congressman Ileana Ross Leighton from Miami, the only Cuban-American in Congress, the first Cuban-American in Congress representing Miami's large Cuban-American community. They interviewed U.S. Senator Chuck Hagel, Tom Osborne, the publisher of the Miami Herald. They interviewed Ricardo Alarcón, the third most powerful man in Cuba, head of the Cuba Parliament. They interviewed Pedro Alvarez, CEO for Alamport. They interviewed all the big wigs and all the hot shots, and then they fanned out, got off the bus, and they interviewed scores of everyday ordinary Cubans, from doctors and lawyers and psychiatrists to 13-year-old prostitutes, social workers, cabbies, taxi drivers, bartenders, teachers, and what they were able to do in the course of the 11 days that they spent in Miami and Havana was to really penetrate below the surface and try and get a much better handle on what is Cuba, what is its history, what are its policies, where is it now, and where is it going, what happens after Castro leaves the stage. And they gathered all of this material in notebook form, in videotape, and they have spent the last 16 weeks methodically putting it together, so they will be able to sketch a portrait of what we think Cuba is all about beyond the stereotypes and the perceptions that we often have to deal with. And we think that that is a great experience for any journalist to have, particularly 22-year-old students from various places in Nebraska who will now take this experience and use it to shape a lot of their professional careers, and it will be you all who will be the ultimate beneficiaries of this trip. So we think you should be very proud of them and that they were tremendous ambassadors for the state of Nebraska. They conducted themselves with a great deal of professional expertise, and they were very fair. They were diligent in trying to get both sides of very complex issues, and it's a very remarkable performance to see students act this professionally at such a young age. So from a journalistic and professorial standpoint, you know, I personally couldn't be happier with the experience that we were able to give them.
Kathy Huddle?
Hi. I wish that some of the what we called the normal students were here today. Joe Dugan and I both took the class as graduate students and professional journalists. I've been at the Journal in Lincoln for almost 25 years. But as Joe Starita says, it was just an amazing experience to watch these kids. In some case, we had two who were, I think, 20. Two sophomores went on this trip, and they were, as Joe says, unbelievable ambassadors for Nebraska and for the university and for the United States. And I think that one of the things that surprised all of us the most is that when we got down there, we didn't really know how we would be accepted, because obviously our countries have been at odds with one another for 44 years now. And what we found was that we were accepted as people. We weren't accepted as journalists. We weren't accepted as students or Americans. We were just accepted as people. And it was a great experience, both for those of us who've been in this profession for a long time, and a wonderful experience for these kids who are just starting out. And the reason most of them aren't here today is because they've all started their summer jobs and they've fanned out into the world, and it's been wonderful to watch them grow from this experience and take off. So we're happy to be here, and we hope we can answer the questions that you have.
Joe Dugan?
Thank you for the introduction, Bill. When I was invited attend this reporting foray in Cuba some 9 months ago, one of my first thoughts was, well, I'm going to need 6 months to scrounge up some connections to Nebraska and Havana to justify my going down there. But yes, I'll go. In fact, I couldn't have been more wrong. The connections between our state and Cuba are quite numerous, from Cuban Americans living in Nebraska to all of our political and policymakers having very strong opinions about what should happen to the embargo, to our ag producers who also have very informed and strong opinions about trading with the country. And so the experience of working on this project has been extremely interesting and I think extremely relevant to Nebraska.
Joe, I'm actually going to start with a question for you. You did part of your reporting assignment was on the embargo and the new opportunities for trade. Could you give a kind of a thumbnail sketch of what American trade policy currently is towards Cuba, why we're now allowed to do some business, and what are the connections in Nebraska? Who is doing trade down there?
For much of the 44 years of the embargo, there was virtually no trade at all between the countries. In 1999, a law was made in Congress that was introduced by Senator Chuck Hagel to allow limited cash trade with Cuba, and that is in the sense of the sales of agricultural goods, food, and medicine. Since then, actually, the United States has become the largest supplier of those goods to Cuba. It's estimated to be over $300 million and counting as the contracts are made. So things have changed very rapidly in the last several years with our ability in the United States to sell agricultural goods to Cuba. In my reporting, I tried to find actual direct sales from Nebraska to Havana, and I know that ConAgra has done some business with the country under this cash sales arrangements, but beyond that, I wasn't able to track down much. Obviously, private businesses want to keep some of those details to themselves on sales, and so... But there is certainly a huge groundswell among the various grain commodity groups, livestock commodity groups, and certainly even among the bean producers in the Panhandle to get in on some of the cash sales to Cuba and also see the embargo end so that trade can be done more freely.
Kathy, when you were talking with regular Cubans, did they have any impression about the embargo?
Yeah, I would say most of the regular Cubans that I talk to oppose the embargo. They feel like it harms their everyday lives. They feel like it makes it more difficult for them to get the things they need. They think they don't have as many choices in food, medication, and that sort of thing. And they're really starving for contact with the outside world, not just the United States, but they're... We were all struck by the fact that we stayed at the Habana Libre, which is a beautiful four-star hotel. None of you, I would wager, have ever stayed in a hotel that had absolutely no newspapers in it. So they're starved for information from the outside, and they blame part of it on the embargo.
Joe, I'm curious with the impressions the students had reporting in a dictatorship and whether... you felt any restrictions on your guys while you were down there?
Restrictions from the Cuban government?
From the Cuban government.
We think that the Cuban government will probably never invite us back again, is our conclusion. We think that the Cuban government basically had the mindset, okay, we've got to 12 snot-nosed little college students coming down. We'll put them on a bus. we'll line up three or four government officials to give them the party line, and we'll show them all the great music and the great salsa dancing and the delightful mojitos, and they'll have a great time, more or less like they were on spring break. They'll go home and they'll write a really wonderful story about what a great place Cuba is. What they will see reflected in an 86-page full-color magazine that we are in final production with and an hour documentary, they will see a much different side of Cuba than they thought they were showing us, because we took these students and we went along with the program up to a point, and then we cut these students loose, and they fanned out all over Havana, 16, 18 hours a day for 8 straight days, and they came back with a lot of information and a lot of observations that will not reflect favorably on the Cuban government view of things. The most important thing these students may have learned in this trip is, what does it feel like to be lied to? They would interview Pedro Alvarez at 10 o'clock in the morning, and Pedro Alvarez would tell them that this is the truth about Cuba, and by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, they had spoken to a dozen ordinary Cubans who were telling them stories that directly contradicted what Pedro Alvarez said. What's a real-life example of that? One of the 12 students we had was an African-American student who will probably be running the Washington Post in about 25 years. Extremely talented, bright, charming kid who has wanted to be a journalist since he was in the womb. He was fascinated about race relations in Cuba. What is it like to be black in Cuba? We were told by various government officials that the revolution took care of all racial problems in Cuba, that there is racial harmony among white Cubans, Afro-Cubans, and mulattoes, and you will find no racial prejudice in Cuba. He stood up after Roberto de Armas made this statement, Mr. Armas being a representative of the Cuban Foreign Ministry. He stood up and said, "Well, Mr. Armas, can you then explain to me why I have been stopped in the lobby of the Hotel Habana Libre 2 and 3 times a day and carded when none of my other colleagues, all of whom are white, have never been carded?" And I can't give you the verbatim exchange, but it was remarkable on a couple of levels, one of which is that Roberto de Armas basically said, "The reason that you have been carded is because people who look like you cause most of our problems with male prostitution, drug trafficking, and stealing things. And outside of that, we have no racial problems in Cuba." If you're 20 years old and you have an experience like this, it goes a long way in making sure that the search for the truth does not stop at the most convenient, obvious places. If the government says A, you want to go out and diligently make sure that the truth isn't somewhere around B, C, or D. And that's what Dakari was able to do, and that is what the students were able to do. In a country that is zealous about controlling information and allowing only one viewpoint to be heard, they redoubled their efforts to make sure that they got multiple viewpoints, often which contradicted the official viewpoint. And we think that that's what journalists are supposed to do, whether it's in Miami or Havana or Lincoln or Baghdad. We don't accept what people tell us necessarily to be true. We want to go out and find as many layers beneath the official government position as we can. And these students at such a young age were exemplary in being able to do that.
Kathy?
I just wanted to add that anyone who's ever worked as a journalist or been around journalists, you know that there are two sides to most stories. There are so many sides to this story, we couldn't believe it. And it, as sort of one of the running themes of the magazine, is how elusive the truth is. And certainly I've never been anywhere, that includes Miami, where you could ask, I would ask a question of someone, they would look me in the eye, they would answer it, and I would think, oh, great, I've got the answer to this question. And I'd go on. Then I'd run into another person, I'd ask the same question, and I would get a diametrically opposed answer. And I believe that both those people thought they were telling the truth. And so it was just an unbelievably complex process and experience for all of us.
And I might add, there were times on the island also when someone would give you their point of view and then pull you aside 5 minutes later and say, you know, I had to lie to you. Well, but that's operating under a dictatorship. That's what happens. I have a question for that. I believe this was a question submitted from Jorge Rodriguez. And to Kathy, how can you blame the embargo for the lack of news at the hotel when Cuba deals with Canada and Mexico and Europe? Doesn't it look more that the government blocks that information? The Cuban government doing away with the embargo will change nothing about this.
Absolutely, and I didn't mean to say that I blame personally that I blame the embargo for anything. And I know the embargo is not responsible for the lack of information. It is the government that restricts the information. I was simply saying that they believe that the embargo has affected them in terms of the availability of certain goods and services, but that in addition to the embargo, they're starved for information because they're not allowed access to it by the government.
We have a lot of questions now, which is wonderful. We appreciate it. Joe, was there any talk of human rights abuses while you were there? And I might call on you to also tell the story of the dissidents and the spies that the kids ended up encountering.
I think the students felt there were some human rights abuses in the way we worked them. But to give a more serious answer to your question, you can't provide to a student journalist a much better experience than the experience of being lied to, because it forces them to really think on their feet and to evaluate a lot of things that eventually will make them better journalists. In some kind of a serendipitous whirl, we had a student. Well, the context, very briefly, is there is a very embedded movement afoot in Cuba right now. The movement is called the Varela Project. The Varela Project is a project that is designed by working within the framework of the Cuban Constitution to allow the people to petition the government of Cuba to have more civil liberties, to have more economic opportunity, basically to be more democratic. We had a student who spent 5 months before we left researching the leaders of the Varela Project, those Cubans on the ground, primarily in Havana, who are trying to push for democratic reform, to be able to say whatever they want whenever they want, to be able to meet in public and have meetings and discuss politics in an open manner without being a fear of reprisal, to have private enterprise come to Cuba. All of these things are under the umbrella of the Varela Project. This student, very fluent in Spanish, perfectly fluent in Spanish, spent 5 months before we left for Miami and Havana researching the Varela Project, learning about the leaders, Osvaldo Paya, Vladimiro Roca, and by the time she got to Havana, she knew a great deal about the Varela Project and the key figures who were trying to bring democratic reform. Sarah Fox is her name. While she was in the 8 days we spent in Havana, she looked up and interviewed and tracked down a 22-year-old student, tracked down eight of these so-called dissidents who are trying to bring democracy to Cuba, working within the framework of the Cuban Constitution. She interviewed Lily for 2 hours in Lily's home. In Lily's home, on the wall, framed above where Lily was sitting during the interview, is a United Nations Charter on Human Rights. Lily spent 2 hours telling Sarah about how she was working hard to bring democracy to Cuba, how the Cuban government has a stranglehold over the people, how the Castro government squeezes off the lifeblood of democracy, how she and the other dissidents were fighting very hard every day to bring democracy to Cuba. When she got back to Lincoln and began the second semester, she began writing the stories of the dissidents that she had interviewed in person, some of whom we have on tape. In early April, a bombshell came out of Havana, the bombshell being that the Castro government had rounded up 75 dissidents, convicted them in week-long trials, and sentenced them to, on average, 23 years in prison. It came out that Lily was a government spy and had been a government spy for 10 years, and whose name was Agent Tanya. And they used Lily's testimony in a Havana courtroom to put Raul Rivero, one of the leading Cuban dissident journalists, in prison for 27 years. So Sarah sat there for 2 hours listening to Lily tell her about how horrible the Cuban government was and how she and all the other journalists and dissidents were leading this democratic movement. When she gets back to Lincoln, she finds out that she was talking to a spy. That's a very useful experience for any journalist to have at any age. But at 22, it's really a kind of a breathtaking experience. So Sarah has now had to go back and obviously revise some of her stories. But it's an indication of just how complicated things can be when you are trying to search for the truth.
Joe Dugan, did you feel you were closely watched while you were there by government or officials?
I didn't, despite the fact that there are soldiers and police officers, especially in the old Havana area, about every square block. I did, on occasion, when talking to just normal citizens or whatever, kind of meet up with fear, people wanting to be pretty quiet about their conversations, not wanting to give names or wanting me to use a pseudonym. But on other occasions, I found people who were more than willing to go on the record, first and last name, and they were very open and critical of the government or their life or telling it like it is. But no, I didn't necessarily feel watched, and I was very surprised with the recent events in April and the roundup and everything. It's been I just got the impression that things are really, really were changing in the country when I was there, historically, and now it seems to be kind of the same old, all over again.
I might say that it's a little different when you have a television camera with you. And I never felt, we were never prohibited, or I'll put it this way, stopped at any point. At one point, we were told not to take pictures of something. Interestingly, it was the family printing business that Jose Novoa, who's here with us today, left 40 years ago, which had a government security guard out in front, and he waved me away, thinking I was just a dumb tourist taking a picture of something I shouldn't. There were also times when the longer we would take pictures of something, the closer a police or a security agent would start to get to us, sort of circling around us. And you know, we got a pretty good rhythm going where we knew that the time to leave was then. So we wouldn't be asked any questions. So there were times when you were aware. And one other thing, every block has a representative of the CDR, the Committee for the Defense of the Revolution, which is a citizen, and they are always out on their front doorstep. And you walk down the street with a camera, or you look like an American, and somebody's checking you out. You do have that sense. Kathy, what about you?
I was just going to say, I don't think that we felt at the time that we were being watched, but it is true that wherever we went, we seemed to attract a crowd of people in uniform. There was an incident one night where we misplaced a couple of the students for a few hours. which was, you know, had a lot of anxiety, but we received a call where we were that the students had been returned to the hotel and were safely in their rooms. We found out much later that they hadn't talked to anyone. So we could only conclude that our comings and goings in and out of the hotel were monitored closely enough that those two particular students had been seen arriving back at the hotel and going to their room. So even though we didn't, Bill's right, we weren't told you cannot go there, you cannot do that. But I think that we'd be kidding ourselves if we think that they didn't pretty much know where we were and what we were doing most of the time.
Joe, do Cuban journalists, especially the ones you spoke with, the Cuban journalists have any freedom to write anything other than the Cuban company line?
Well, they did before April 11th. There had been a period of 3 or 4 years where independent journalists in Cuba had been given an extraordinary amount of leeway, an unprecedented amount of leeway. Raul Rivero was allowed to start a magazine. These independent journalists actually created somewhat of a cottage industry where they were filing reports from Havana with the government's, if not blessing, at least tolerance. They would file these reports to Europe. They would file these reports to Miami. Many of their stories were available on the internet to the huge Cuban American community in Miami, and they were available throughout Europe. And these were kinds of the stories that you would never see in Granma, the state-controlled newspaper, or Juventud Rebelde, the youth communist newspaper. You would never see these stories in those papers. They were stories about ammonia leaks at a factory that caused problems. Those aren't the kinds of stories you see in Granma. The independent journalists would take these stories. They would file them to their contacts in Spain or in France or in Germany or in Miami, and they would get paid. In fact, they would often get paid more for one story than the average Cuban makes in a month. They might get paid $50 for a story. The average Cuban makes $10 a month. So a very interesting experiment was going on with the Castro government allowing a certain group of journalists to act independently of the government controls. No one was really sure where this experiment was going to end. On April 10th and 11th, they found out where it was going to end. It ended with very lengthy prison sentences for many of these independent journalists. And there's a number of reasons why that probably is that are also complicated. I don't want to give a picture here that the Cuban government is all wrong and that the U.S. government is all right. I don't believe that's the truth. I believe the U.S. government has some responsibility in this also. And I think that the United States interest section in Havana has done some shameful things, some very provocative things, and, in my opinion, some very stupid things that allowed the Castro government to use this as a dodge, and now there are 75 people in prison, maybe as a result of that. I don't think it's completely black and white, and I don't think that the U.S. interest section has been doing things in Havana that are necessarily appropriate, and they're not the kinds of things that the United States Embassy does in Beijing, for example, if you want to draw a parallel.
We got a ton of questions that I want to motor through here. Joe Dugan, Lincoln Journal Star, has not our embargo increased the hunger and lack of food in Cuba?
Well, given our proximity and our ability to produce agricultural products, I think that's a logical conclusion. And certainly, while I didn't see blatant evidence of malnutrition, I heard over and over and over again from people the just extreme hassle of getting enough to eat on a daily basis, especially with, you know, the amount of money they're paid. There's a thriving black market. There are government stores that ironically, you can only purchase some things with dollars, even though that they are paid in pesos. And so, you know, there's really a pretty intriguing dichotomy going on there. But
do you have a sense as to whether that's the embargo or Castro using food as a control mechanism for his people?
I don't know that I could answer that for sure, but certainly I think Castro has used the embargo. I mean, he has certainly used that as cover for some of the failings of his government. But, you know, certainly if the United States could have free access to Cuba, there would be more food on the island, no question about it.
Actually, I may start by answering this. Did your group include farmers from Nebraska? No, it didn't. There were a couple of kids with rural backgrounds. Our documentary and some of the reporting, however, spoke with farmers that have had either visits to Cuba or trade with Cuba already. One in particular, Tom Reiber from Gibbon, who we feature prominently, is surprisingly ambivalent about trade with Cuba. He's an interesting guy because he recognizes both that there is a certain, albeit limited, market with Cuba, both because they're limited to cash and also, you know, it's 12 million people, and that's the size of a suburb in Hong Kong right now, and so it may not be as large a market as perhaps people anticipate. But he's also very, very aware that, well, what are the implications of trading with a dictator? And it's more of a struggle than you might figure from a guy that would see the profit margin in there. I'm not sure which of, I believe, Joe, you went to a church at one point also, didn't you?
Yes.
Joe Dugan?
Yes.
We have just a question about, did you come in contact with church folks and what their role in being dissidents are also?
Yeah, I worked on one of the stories for the magazine. I worked on taking a look at religion in Cuba post-revolution. And really, after the revolution, Castro, Caribbean Karl Marx, called religion the opiate of the masses. Communist Party members were not allowed to worship. Church attendance plummeted. And also even the practice of Santeria, the Afro-Cuban religion indigenous to the island, also kind of went underground. Well, at the fall of the Soviet Union, when food really became scarce and people started turning to a higher power to get them through this difficult period, the government loosened those restrictions. And as a result, both Catholic and Protestant churches are growing on the island, although Catholicism is kind of leveled off based upon some of the priests that I talked to. And Santeria is very widely, openly practiced.
Another one of those surprising Nebraska connections, the director of the Cuban AIDS Project is a physician in North Platte, Nebraska, through an interesting series of circumstances, and that project is managed out of the Montserrat Church, Catholic Church, by a rather remarkable guy named Father Fernando. Both the students reporting has reflected that, and that's also one of the stories in our documentary as well. Boy, you guys ask good questions. One of the things you constantly hear is that despite all the problems Castro has, Castro has still supplied the people with health care and education to a substantial degree. Your comments. Kathy?
I don't think that there's a single person I talk to, and probably not a person that any of us talk to, that didn't bring up health care and education as the successes of the revolution. However, we did hear a few smart cracks about the education maybe not being quite as good as the government would like you to believe. I think it is true. I think that you can't deny the fact that Cuba has the largest, the highest literacy rate in, what is it, in Latin America, right? That's a fact. You can't deny it. The people are literate, they're educated, their health care is free. We did, however, visit a couple of hospitals, and they're not a hospital that any of you would even consider staying in. And it is the case that your health care is free, but you may have to take along your own bandages, your own sheets, your own towels, your own aspirin, your own medication, your own sutures if you require surgery. So it's another sort of yes and no. I think that that's a big success, but I think that particularly since the Soviet Union fell, the health care has suffered.
Did you see many tourists there and any Americans? The short answer is yes, lots of Europeans and a handful of Americans. And Joe Sterita, University of Nebraska College of Journalism, would you recommend travel to Cuba?
Well, I can speak for all three of us, I think. I would overwhelmingly endorse people going to Cuba. Cuba's a fascinating place. It's one of the most I've been to dozens of countries. It's one of the most interesting places I've ever been. Why sit here and try and figure out what Cuba is or what Cuba isn't, if you can go and see for yourself? I mean, that's always my preference, whether it's Cuba or any place else. I am, again, I speak personally here, I'm 100% opposed to a travel ban on Cuba. I don't believe my government has the right to tell me whether I can go to Cuba or not. I ought to be able to make that decision myself. I also believe that the embargo, and again, I'm speaking for myself, I believe the embargo is a totally foolish idea. I completely support the idea of bringing reform to Cuba, but I don't believe the embargo is going to achieve that. Fidel Castro has been in power for 44 years. Has the embargo worked? What I believe will work is the more tourists who go to Cuba and the more exposure the Cuban people get to the other world and the other way of life, the less willing they are going to be to endure the kinds of hardships they endure. Alberto Ibarguen, the publisher of the Miami Herald, opened his interview with us on January 2nd by saying, as you might expect the publisher of a major metropolitan daily to say, that he believes sunlight is the best disinfectant. Well, I believe that to be true not only journalistically, but I also believe that to be true politically. If you want to change the government in Cuba, let the people of Cuba see what they're missing. Let the people of Cuba know more about the outside world and the options and the choices that we all have. Let them see more of that, not less of that. Because if there is going to be fundamental change in Cuba, and there has to be, the more people who come there is going to accelerate that change. And I can tell you, as can Joe and Kathy, that the younger generation in Cuba right now is not one that you could build a socialist empire on with any degree of confidence. This is a generation who sees nothing good, really, in coming out of their way of life. They want change. And the more they see of the outside world, the more inclined they're going to be to demand change. Tom Osborne, of all people, uses a quote in our documentary and in our magazine when asked the very same question. And Tom Osborne, his view of the embargo is, if you have run the same play up the middle for 44 years and you haven't gained any yardage, maybe it's time to pass.
Joe Dugan, when U.S. policy towards Cuba was formulated so many years ago, do you think anyone in Washington at the time thought Castro would still be there in the 21st century?
Their view probably changed after the Bay of Pigs, but no, I can't imagine that anyone thought he would still be around.
I might add that both Jose Novoa and Jorge Rodriguez, who are here, when they left the island, both assumed that they were going to be back a matter of weeks, a matter of months, maybe a couple of years, that this guy was a short-timer. And needless to say, everybody's been surprised. What is the speculation about the future of Cuba after Castro was gone, especially the speculation on the street? I'm going to turn to Kathy Huddle, who appears to be our street reporter here.
Well, again, that's a question that I think all of us ask most of the people we met, and the replies are varied. I may be a little bit in the minority on my answer here because I got really strong from a couple of people. The answer was, we simply don't know. We're not sure we're ready to go on without him, simply because the comparison they made to me is, you know, in the United States, you have a president for 4 years, 8 years max. This man has been their leader for 44 years. It's very difficult for people of any age, and certainly for people 44 years and younger, who've grown up entirely within the revolution, to conceive of life without him. But as Joe says, I think they are ready for change. No one knows what form that change is going to take. But he can't live forever, even though that seems to be his plan.
A lot of the people I talked to also said that, you know, McDonald's is kind of the symbol of what capitalism is. They all talk about McDonald's, and very more than a few people said to me, we want some sort of change that isn't McDonald's. You know, we want a freer market. We want to be able to purchase things, have easy access to food, so on and so forth, but we don't want pure American-style capitalism.
And I think it is ironic, as Americans visiting there, is there is something awfully refreshing about visiting a place where there are no billboards and there's you know, not an Applebee's on every corner and the like. But you realize that there's this give and take, and when the change happens, that's part of going to be the side effect. Follow up on that, Joe. Did you find any grassroots people, not government, not dissident, who still believe in Castro and the revolution? What do they say?
That's an interesting question. And again, time and time again, while some people may have felt freely or confident enough to criticize certain aspects of government policy, I don't recall hearing one person personally attack Fidel Castro. I can only recall on about two occasions when they actually used his name. And there's a certain degree of respect, even among people who are not happy with the way he's run the country. There is a certain amount of respect afforded him.
And fear. I think that's where a lot of the reluctance to use his name and talk about it comes from. I mean, we were out one day, we're in the middle of a cemetery, nobody close, and Joe and I were talking with these two guys about 40 years old, and we asked them these questions, and even without any possibility that we could see of them being overheard, they would criticize a lot of things pretty openly. They would not specifically criticize Castro.
I mean, if you're 44 years old or younger in Cuba, you've only known one leader, and most of the population is under 44. That would be the same as John F. Kennedy still being our president. Mm-hmm. Which seems absolutely preposterous. They both came into power roughly the same time. And to for us to sit here in May of 2003 and JFK would still be in the White House. I mean, this is a man who's endured outlived 10 US presidencies. And so just by virtue of longevity, he's the only leader they've ever known for the majority of the people there.
The questioner asked, did you have an opportunity to see or experience the daily lives of ordinary Cubans? I think the clip from the documentary showed a little bit of that. But the extra question is kind of interesting. Joe Dugan, what do they do to survive?
Three or four or five jobs. In fact, if they can get a doorman's position at one of the hotels, all the better. They try to get access to dollars, and that was our experience in Havana. I can only guess as to what it's like in the rural areas, what people do to survive. But, you know, there's also just a tremendous amount of culture and these people are vivacious and friendly, and they look you in the eye, and they're confident, and they're literate, and they love music, and they welcome you. And so, I mean, it's not, I don't want to give the impression that it's completely Spartan existence. I mean, Cubans have a tremendous sense of good humor, and I think that, more than anything, has helped them endure the hardships that they've had to.
The automobiles that everyone always marvels at, that they see the pictures of that are still operating in Cuba, I think are a pretty amazing symbol of the remarkable resiliency that the Cuban people have, that it's like their everyday lives. They just keep these things running. It is a Cuba survives on its black market economy. That may be parts for your car. That may be prostitution. That may be getting food for your family. In one case, we had a camera severely damaged, a pretty sophisticated piece of electronic equipment.
Be sure and tell them how that happened.
Within a our driver backed over our camera. It's a $10,000 piece of equipment. Within 40 minutes, there had been arrangements made through various channels to get this camera repaired through the back door of Cuban state television, that they'd sneak it past security, get it upstairs, the engineers would take care of it, get the parts, and that'd be it, all cash. We didn't have to do that, but this was within 40 minutes with somebody who had no contacts within Cuban state television. But everybody knows somebody to get things done. It's a remarkably ingenious backdoor economy that may survive, allows this country to survive, I'd say. Maybe just the very last question from each of you. Did you come away with a very different notion of Cuba and its people coming out of this trip? Joe Dugan, Lincoln Journal Star, I'll start with you.
I would just have to echo the sentiments of Joe Streeton saying that no matter, we spent 3 months studying Cuba, reading about it, reading current press accounts and history and travel guides and everything we could consume, and none of that could truly prepare for being in the country, just one of the most fascinating, interesting, complex places on the planet. And So just being there totally turned me upside down.
Kathy Huddle, Lincoln Journal Star.
I'd say the same thing, and the same thing as I started with, and that is that I think that we were all surprised by the generosity and friendliness and warmness of the people we met. We've painted a pretty grim picture, and there's no doubt about it. Their lives on a daily basis are hard. They're really hard. Compared to us, they have absolutely nothing. But they're not beaten. They're not defeated. There's a pride and a just a passion for life that I had not seen anywhere else. And, you know, you hear a lot of talk about the old American cars. They're very cool. For those of us of a certain age, they're very cool because, obviously, we remember when they were new. But that's not the only thing. This place is by necessity, sort of frozen in time from 44 years ago. And it's an experience that unless you go there, I don't know where else in the world you'd go to find it right now. So, yeah, our impressions coming home were different than our impressions going over there. And I second Joe's statement. If you have a way to get there, get there.
Quick caveat on that. If you are traveling as a tourist, you can face an up to $15,000 fine from the United States Treasury, unless you're going down as on a with a humanitarian permit, with a certified educational group, which was greatly restricted within the last couple of months, or as a journalist. So while yes, it's a cool opportunity, there are great risks, and it is against the policy of the United States government.
This then would be a really good time to mention that you can go completely legally through the Cuba AIDS Project, which you can find online. And if you agree to take medication and other things that the AIDS Project needs, they have a license that allows people to travel in their name.
Do not pack your swim fins. Do not pack your golf clubs, because that's what they're looking for. And that's what humanitarian outfits like the Cuban AIDS Project will say. You know, you understand. You're there helping us. So, Joe Storita, your final comments on how your image of Cuba changed?
Well, I would say that I thought it was really interesting, and it was really good that we went to Miami first, particularly if you look at it through the eyes of these very young 19, 20, 21, 22-year-old kids. They have no idea what it's like to lose your country. Most of us in this room have no idea what it's like to lose your country. And for 3 days in Miami, they were hit with this kind of undiluted passion that was disorienting to them. I mean, they heard things day after day after day from people that sounded really almost crazy to them. They had never encountered this kind of passion for anything. And they couldn't quite understand how can this many people be this passionate about the embargo, about tourism, about a travel ban, about politics. It was just almost intimidating. Then, on the morning of January 4th, they walk out into Havana and they begin to understand the passion that you feel when you lose something this beautiful and this full of life. The buildings are just magnificent. The people are friendly. They love Americans. I think that was shocking to these students from Nebraska who ended up on the streets of Havana. They expected the animosity and the acrimony between the two governments to bleed over onto the street. Well, they found just the opposite. Almost everybody they encountered wanted to talk to them, were very curious about who they were, and it's like news from the outside world. They were very struck by how many everyday, ordinary Cubans really warmed to them. So it was an exhilarating experience to, first of all, get hit with all of this undiluted passion in Miami, and then 3 days later hook it up to why these people were so passionate. They were passionate because they had lost their homeland. And it's a very beautiful, interesting, fascinating country, and so they were able to understand for the first time in their lives what it's like to lose your home. And again, whether you're a journalist or a citizen of the world, that's a very useful experience. So now these kids, they are like one-stop shopping for Cuba news. They follow everything about Cuba. It was never on their radar screen before January 1st. Every one of these students will find something in the New York Times or the Washington Post, and they'll email it to all the other students. It's like no matter what happens with Cuba, everybody in this group knows about it because Cuba is now on their radar screen, not just as a journalistic enterprise, but it's something that is introducing them to this bigger, more complicated world of adults that they're really intrigued by. And you can give somebody an A for that. And
Joe, if they want to get a copy of the student's final project?
We need to get addresses, I guess, because we will find a way. It should be out in mid-June, and it's the culmination of a year's worth of work, and it says in story form a lot of what we've been saying here with gorgeous photos and layouts and everything else. It'll be available in mid-June, and the best I can do right now is you could call the University of Nebraska College of Journalism, and they will be able to place an order. Otherwise, maybe we can try and get your names and email addresses from somebody at the Omaha Press Club and make sure. I think you'll enjoy it. It's quite a publication for kids who don't have degrees.
I'd like to thank our panelists, Joe Sterita, University of Nebraska College of Journalism, Kathy Huddle, and Joe Dugan from the Lincoln Journal-Star for sharing their time. Thank you very much to KIOS for taping the broadcast and the Omaha Press Club for hosting us, and also for some support from the Nebraska Humanities Council for putting this Cuba show on the road as we've gone around the state and shared the story as well. Thank you all for coming out today.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. Today's topic was Cuba, the Nebraska Connection. The members of the panel were Kathy Huddle, Sunday editor of the Lincoln Journal-Star, Joe Dugan, a reporter and student at UNL, Joe Sterita, a UNL professor who leads the depth reporting class, and Bill Kelly, NETV executive producer. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, May 22, 2003, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Gary Kerr for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club holds these noontime educational forums each month. The next forum will be Thursday, June 19th at 12 noon. The topic will be the Omaha Performing Arts Center, what it will look like, how it came to be. If you'd like to attend this or other future forums, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.